Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
How did it come about?
Let's have a bit of history.
It is not black and white, is it?
That raises big questions.
There are repercussions around the world.
It's a hugely complicated picture.
The official narrative is somewhat different.
For a greater understanding of the stories affecting our lives, search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 14th of May, these are our main stories. Donald Trump's former lawyer says he conspired to bury stories that would have harmed the former president's 2016 election campaign. People flee the Kharkiv region in northeastern Ukraine as Russian forces advance. Also in this podcast, hundreds are killed by flash flooding in northern Afghanistan.
After a few days, there could be a lot of spread of disease because the sanitation is not there. As you said, the infrastructure is not there.
And one of the world's most wanted people smugglers, Barzan Majid, has been arrested in northern Iraq. Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York is now into its fifth week, and on Monday, the prosecution's main witness, Michael Cohen, began giving his evidence. A confidant of the former US president, he once said that he would take a bullet for his former boss. Mr. Cohen paid off the porn star Stormy Daniels to buy her silence ahead of the 2016 election. This was to stop her claiming she'd had sex with him 10 years earlier, an allegation the former president denies. He's on trial for falsifying business records when he reimbursed Mr. Cohen, which Mr. Trump also denies. The court heard a recording of a conversation the two men had about paying off another woman, the former Playboy model Karen McDougal.
And I've spoken to Alan Weisselberg about how to set the whole thing up with funding. Yes. When it comes time for the financing, which will be...
Listen, what financing?
We'll have to pay you. So.
Don't pay with cash.
No.
Mr. Cohen has already served a prison sentence for his part in the Stormy Daniels hush money affair, among other charges. I've been talking to our correspondent at the trial in New York, Neda Torfik.
Well, this has been quite detailed testimony, perhaps the most detailed so far, because Michael Cohen has directly in his testimony tied Donald Trump to everything that he did. And he has detailed his conversations. He says before Donald Trump even announced his run for the presidency that Donald Trump told Cohen to be prepared to deal with negative stories, telling him there's going to be a lot of women coming forward. And on the stand, Michael Cohen said they eventually did, and that Cohen himself feared the Stormy Daniels story could be catastrophic to Trump's campaign. And he said Trump was fuming at the time, telling him it was going to be a disaster, a total disaster, and that women were going to hate him. Cohen says at that point, Donald Trump directed him, just do it, make the payment. So Cohen directly tying Donald Trump to the hush money payment. And he says that he ultimately ended up being the one fronting the money because nobody else would. But he said before he wired the $130,000 to Stormy Daniels' lawyer that he called Donald Trump to get his sign-off, and the court was actually shown two phone calls from Cohen to Trump that morning before the wire was done. And then we finally got to the questions that are at the heart of this case, the way Cohen was reimbursed and whether the company falsified business records. And Cohen testified that in front of Donald Trump, Weisselberg explained to him that he would be paid in monthly installments and that those would be classified as a retainer for legal services.
This all feels familiar territory. Did we learn anything new?
I think what we learned new was a bit of what was Donald Trump's intent. We heard in these kind of personal conversations how Donald Trump felt when the Stormy Daniels story came out, if it was really about his family. Michael Cohen saying actually he wasn't worried about Melania at all. It was all for the campaign. But very much so, we are going over, you know, incidents that have been reported time and time again. But nevertheless, it's incredibly important to this case because jurors ultimately are using Michael Cohen's testimony along with the corroborating evidence to decide if Trump had intent to defraud.
And we're going to hear more from Michael Cohen.
We are. I mean, Michael Cohen could be on the stand for quite some time yet. You know, we have gone through some key timelines, but prosecutors still have more questioning to do. So we haven't even gotten to cross-examination by Donald Trump's defense team yet. And that is sure to be extremely intense because key to them making sure that Donald Trump is either acquitted or, you know, they get a, or getting a mistrial with at least one juror being undecided. Key to that is trying to undermine Michael Cohen's credibility. So no doubt they will spend as much time as they can doing that.
Neda Torfik in New York. Next to Ukraine. This is the sound of Russian shells landing just a few hundred metres away as Ukrainian police evacuate people from a village close to the front line in the northeast. These men were among those who fled the latest Russian advance around Ukraine's second city, Kharkiv.
I was in the house alone and they opened fire at the door. They're sending me to the hospital in Kharkiv. I have no fingers, they're broken.
Half a kilometre away, there's fighting with automatic weapons. Tanks are constantly approaching, shooting back and then leaving. I thought it would be okay. I was shocked myself.
I've been talking to our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale, who's in Kharkiv.
There have been conflicting reports. The Russians say they've entered the town of Vovchansk, which is probably the biggest, most populated town near the Russian border. Most of the people have already fled. Ukraine firmly denies that. In fact, the governor of Kharkiv region was in Vovchansk today saying civilians, the last remaining ones, are being evacuated. Not that there are many left or many buildings intact. We spoke to some people who'd fled over the last 24 hours from that town and they said they could hear heavy machine guns, which tells you the fighting was very close. But I think the bigger issue has been Ukraine's defences and were they up to it? And I think those questions are being asked here. Some people saying that, yes, there were defences, but they weren't fortified enough. They were in the wrong place. And the fact that one senior Ukrainian commander in this region has been removed from his post, I think tells you essentially this wasn't meant to happen.
I was going to say, President Volodymyr Zelensky has confirmed this change of personnel in his TV address this evening. I mean, as you say, that's like an admission that the thing is going badly.
Things go back and forth in war, and both sides make mistakes, and commanders get replaced. You know, Russia's just replaced the defence minister, so I don't think we should read too much into that. But there's no doubt, Ukraine is being probed right across this 800-mile front. And for a new front to open here in the Kharkiv region has made life very difficult for Ukraine, who are struggling with both manpower and ammunition at the moment, waiting for that US supplies, those US supplies to start arriving in serious quantities. But the one crumb of comfort for Ukraine is that so far in this war, neither side have been able to completely breach each other's defences. Yes, Ukraine's have crumbled this year. Russia's made advances in some parts of the front, including here, but also in the east. But they have not yet, the Ukrainian defences, completely collapsed.
If we wind right back to the start of the conflict, everyone thought the Ukrainian military would be easily overwhelmed by Russia's greater power and strength militarily. It's taken so much longer than anyone expected, but is that basically what we're seeing now?
Well, yeah, it has been a war of attrition. I think that, you know, looking forward, it's which side can keep recruiting the numbers of troops they need. And remember, Russia has been essentially recruiting about 25,000 to 30,000 new troops a month, but also the industrial capability. Now, Russia's been setting its own economy on a war footing, and that's further confirmation by the removal of Sergei Shoigu and being replaced by somebody who's got an economics background, whereas Ukraine is almost, not completely, but very reliant on the West and them ramping up their production. And let's be honest, the West's been very, very slow. So it's really who's going to outlast who. Russia has a bigger population. It has a war economy. Ukraine has a smaller population. It's starting to mobilise more troops. But it is reliant on the West to provide it with weapons and ammunition.
Now, from Jonathan Beale in Kharkiv to Memorial Day in Israel, when the country remembers its war dead. It's meant to unify the country, but this year Israel is so divided over Gaza and the fate of Israeli hostages, the day didn't pass off without trouble. Paul Adams is in Jerusalem.
At 11 this morning, sirens wailed over Israel for a minute and life briefly came to a halt. Israelis pausing to reflect on those who have died in the course of the country's turbulent history. This year already among the worst in living memory. At a ceremony in Jerusalem, the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke, not for the first time, of an existential conflict between Israel and its enemies.
This is what the war is all about. It's either us, Israel, or them, the Hamas monsters. Either continued existence, liberty, security and prosperity, or destruction, slaughter, rape and enslavement.
Unity is in short supply this year. In Ashdod, there was heckling and scuffles at a ceremony where the hardline Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, was speaking. In Tel Aviv, protesters held up placards saying the blood of Israeli hostages was on the government's hand. In the West Bank, Israeli settlers once again blockaded an aid convoy bound for Gaza, ransacking trucks at will and throwing food on the ground. Videos from the scene suggested that soldiers present did nothing to intervene. In the Gaza Strip, meanwhile, fighting returned to the north, with gunfire echoing through the streets of the Jabalia refugee camp. Israel says it's seen signs of Hamas regrouping there and has been forced to act. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has warned that an all-out assault on Rafah in the south may simply provoke anarchy without actually eliminating Hamas.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. It's been 3 days now since northern Afghanistan was overwhelmed by flash flooding, killing more than 300 people. Taliban officials have told the BBC that search and rescue operations will intensify, but the number of dead or missing could rise significantly. The humanitarian organisation Save the Children estimates that more than 500,000 people have been severely affected. Yama Baraz is from the BBC's Afghan service. I spoke to him as he made his way to Baghlan province, one of the worst hit areas.
It is depressing. It is something which I personally had seen in disaster movies, I would say. But the spirits is high. The officials which I spoke to, they seem optimistic. They said that the reaction from the international community is promising. Although the aid which has been promised, they are not all delivered yet. The people in the affected areas, they are suffering still. They are looking for shelter. They are looking for tents, food. And they are asking the international community and Taliban authorities to do more.
And is the area in any way prepared for this kind of thing? Is flash flooding a normal thing in northern Afghanistan?
Not at all. Not at all. Not only this area. About Afghanistan, the experts said that it is one of those 10 countries which have been affected very badly by climate change, and one of those countries which is very poorly equipped to deal with such a dire situation.
And do you get the sense that there's anyone there to help? You talked about trying to get aid to people. You mentioned the authorities. Is there anyone there able to offer any assistance to the people caught up in this?
From the international community, the members of UN, NWFP and other organizations, they are on the ground. There are people that you can see that they are trying to help, but the aid is not enough. The routes are closed, the roads are destroyed, so the aid cannot be effectively delivered.
So obviously there'll be concerns about food, about sanitation. These kind of basic human needs won't be there for the people who've lost their homes.
that's a matter of concern for a lot of people, because they are saying that after a few days, there could be a lot of spread of disease because the sanitation is not there. As you said, the infrastructure is not there. So, yes, the situation is dire, but from the international community, as well as local people from around other provinces, it seems that the response is huge.
Yama Barras from the BBC's Afghan service. Still to come in this podcast.
We think that the opera theatre will be a place for everyone, not only a place for an elite.
A night to remember for children at the opera.
I was drawn to the mountains even as a little girl, simply out of a passion and a desire to move around in nature.
Five mountaineers with the same personal goal, to be the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest peaks.
I wanted to push myself to the limit.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their inspiring story.
You find something inside you to continue.
Our own strength.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It was a shocking trial broadcast live on television for 7 weeks. It featured TV footage showing the accused repeatedly kicking and punching his wife and dragging her by the hair near naked into a room where she later died. A few hours ago, the case ended with a former economy minister of Kazakhstan, Kanduk Bishimbayev, being found guilty of murder. He was sentenced to 24 years in prison. The accused man was a member of Kazakh's elite. Therefore, this case has prompted much soul-searching. I've been talking to our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, and started by asking him to tell me more about Kanduk Bishimbayev.
He's a 44-year-old businessman. He was briefly the economy minister. He was someone who's actually had a previous conviction of embezzlement and given a 10-year sentence, but was freed with an amnesty on that front. And obviously a significant and wealthy person, so a member of Kazakhstan's elite.
OK, and context is everything with these kind of stories and cases. In Kazakhstan, domestic violence is a huge thing.
It absolutely is. I mean, it's been a major problem. So according to official statistics, about 80 women are killed every year. But a UN-backed study from a few years ago said the real figure is probably about 400 deaths a year. And even that may well be an underestimate because lots of these crimes go unreported. So it's a serious problem, not just in Kazakhstan, not just Central Asia either, but it's something that the UN is trying to tackle. It's one of the UN's Sustainable Development Goals to eliminate all violence against women and girls, both in the private and public sphere. And it's something that the president, Kasym Jomart Tokayev, has also promised to take action on. He has promised a fairer and more equitable society.
And often the way when you get the attention on the issue through a high-profile case like this, that the government is pressured to do more than it might otherwise do.
This is very much the case in this trial. The killing of Saltanat Nukyenova in November really captured the attention of Kazakhstan. And the trial, of course, being streamed live, has really turned into a test case, both of the authorities' willingness to clamp down on these abuses and also to tackle the problem of impunity in the elite. But it's one thing, of course, bringing a very high-profile figure to justice in this case, sentencing him to 24 years in a maximum security prison. But it's another thing, of course, to have a consistent approach that lasts over years. So in terms of enforcing laws consistently, training prosecutors, the judiciary, law enforcement, and also raising awareness more broadly from schools upwards.
And seeing that at all levels of society as well.
Absolutely. So this is, as I said, for a long time, Kazakhstan's political elite was seemed to be untouchable. From that perspective, it's definitely a test case. But it's really what happens in the years ahead that matter. Now, the trial, one thing it did do, it prompted new legislation on this front. So a month ago, the president signed into law measures to criminalise domestic violence, which previously had not been the case. That was the sense that domestic abuse, if it was deemed to be minor, was largely people were let off or given small fines and things like this. So there is a change in the law that came while this case was actually being heard.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, reporting. A man who was pulled from the rubble of a building in South Africa almost 30 hours after it collapsed has told the BBC of the hell he experienced. A minute's silence was held on Monday to mark a week since almost 30 people died and more than 80 were trapped in the city of George. Our correspondent in Johannesburg, Shingai Nyoka, spoke to the survivor in his first broadcast interview.
Delvin Safers, who is a 29-year-old electrician, is counting himself lucky. Last Monday, just after 2 p.m., he was on the third floor of a five-story building with a colleague when the building completely gave way, trapping him in the debris. It was more than a full day after the building's collapse that rescuers pulled him from the rubble. He was taken to hospital with a broken rib. He told the BBC what it was like as he waited to be found.
It was difficult. It was horrible. It was like hell. Because I was laying on top of broken concrete pieces for 28 hours and I couldn't really move my arms, my shoulders, my legs, everything was just shaking in pain. I'm not going to make it.
Rescue teams have worked tirelessly since the building collapsed to find survivors. 81 people, mostly construction workers like Delvin Safers, were on site at the time. Almost 30 of his colleagues are now confirmed to have died. Around two dozen more are still missing. Some relatives have expressed frustration at the pace of the identification of their loved ones. Over the weekend, a man was rescued alive after 5 days in what the Western Cape Provincial Premier Alan Wind called a miracle we've all been hoping for. And while chances of survival are fading, Delvin Safers is still hopeful more of his colleagues will be found alive.
Shingai Nyoka reporting. A group of international parliamentarians named in the trial of the high-profile imprisoned Hong Kong democracy activist Jimmy Lai have written to the authorities offering to testify as witnesses. Mr. Lai, a billionaire media mogul, is accused of colluding with foreign forces and endangering national security. He could face life in prison if found guilty. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor Celia Hatton told me more about what the nine politicians from eight different countries had to say.
The people who've signed this letter, they're all part of the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China. They're saying, look, we have been cited in dozens of pieces of evidence that have been submitted to court. They've been called witnesses or accomplices to this alleged crime, but they themselves have never been contacted by the prosecutors. And so they're saying, look, we would like to testify on our own behalf. We are credible witnesses. We're all elected lawmakers or formerly elected lawmakers. And so you should call us to the stand. You should want to speak to us because we can help shed light on what's going on.
Pretty embarrassing for the Chinese authorities to have people saying, you know, please let us testify.
Absolutely. These are quite well-respected lawmakers from Japan, Germany, France, Canada, and the UK. And so it's quite embarrassing for especially the Hong Kong authorities who are still trying to show that Jimmy Lai, he is being tried in a free and fair court. And so the lawmakers essentially are calling their bluff on this to say, look, if this really is the kind of trial that you say it is, then you should want to speak to us. And look, we're putting ourselves forward. Mm.
In China, across Asia, the concept of saving face in any situation is so culturally powerful. How do the Chinese authorities get out of this situation and save face?
That's a really good question. I mean, I'll be shocked if these people are actually called to testify because they'll be given such a massive platform under which they can really boost Jimmy Lai's case. How will the Hong Kong authorities argue away this offer? I think they might say, look, we have written submissions. We have all the evidence we need. Thank you very much. But the trial is quite far gone. We're working way through it very quickly. And we would like to just press ahead. We have not heard from the Department of Justice yet. A letter was submitted to them today from the Interparliamentary Alliance on China. And so we will hear. I will also add that the Interparliamentary Alliance on China is very unpopular with China's communist leaders. They have called them anti-China before. Now, this is a group of lawmakers from around the world. And it includes people like the U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, the former British Prime Minister Liz Truss, people who really have built political careers on criticizing China. So I don't think that the Hong Kong courts will be eager to allow members of this group to testify in a Hong Kong court.
It's hard to imagine a letter that could have arrived today that would have annoyed them more, in fact.
Exactly. So it'll be fascinating to see what they say in response.
Our Asia Pacific editor Celia Hatton with me. A German high court has upheld a ruling that the intelligence services can investigate the far-right AfD party as a suspected extremist organisation. The German security agency argued that the statements made by party members were evidence of extremism, but the AfD said the comments didn't represent it as a whole. The ruling could undermine support for the AfD in upcoming elections, as our correspondent in Berlin, Damien McGuinness, explains.
Today's court decision means that German intelligence can monitor the party's activities and communications. This may put off wavering voters in the upcoming European Parliament elections and in key regional elections in September in eastern Germany, where the AfD is doing well in the polls. The ruling, though, will certainly give a boost to those calling for the party to be banned. The legal hurdles for that are high, but even the debate around a ban is not something AfD leaders want. Although the party has become more radical over the years, it's also trying to detoxify in order to one day have a chance of getting into government.
One of Europe's most wanted people smugglers, nicknamed the Scorpion, has been arrested in Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq. He was detained on Sunday by local Kurdish forces. Last week, the BBC tracked down and confronted Barzan Majid, who's been on the run for more than 12 months. Sue Mitchell, a BBC journalist, made a podcast about the search, and she spoke to my colleague Matthew Amroliwala.
Events have moved really rapidly after the transmission of the podcast. The Iraqi authorities immediately got in touch with us and said, what evidence could we provide to them? We've had communication with them and with the National Crime Agency here in Britain. And this morning at 7 a.m, they sent police forces out to arrest Barzan Majid in Iraq, in Sulaymaniyah, in the north of Iraq. As far as we know, he's now been held in detention. And there is great interest with police forces across Britain and in Belgium waiting to find out what terms for extradition there might be.
That is such a development because, of course, police forces have been searching for this man. Mm. And it took your investigation to find him. When you tracked him down, what did he actually say to you?
Yeah, it was quite amazing to actually find him, really. And the search had taken us through Europe into Turkey and then on to Iraq. When we finally confronted him with his crimes, he admitted smuggling 10,000 or more people into Britain. He said he couldn't remember how many. He was very blasé about the dangers and the risks on his crossings. There had been incidents of great injury. He was blaming the migrants themselves, saying they knew those risks when they went into these small boats. And he really said that he was doing this job because people begged him to get them to the UK. So as far as he was concerned, he saw himself as not really doing anything wrong. He has been in hiding, and obviously he never thought we would find him. So he was very surprised and must be really baffled by recent developments today. So,
just take us through what is likely to happen next. I suspect it's a very fluid situation, but of course he's wanted in several different countries. So do we have any sort of idea where he is going to go end up?
Well, I was speaking to the Iraqi authorities just in the last hour, and they are very, very keen to start questioning him themselves. They've got instances they want to put to him. Then they're liaising, obviously, with Britain and with Belgium. Police forces in other countries as well want to have input into what's going to happen to him next. As we understand it, he'll be in Iraq for some time now while he's questioned in detail by authorities there, and they're going to keep us abreast of developments. For them, they see it as highlighting a real step forward in dealing with smugglers at this kind of level, at this top level.
For more, search for the podcast To Catch a Scorpion, available wherever you get your BBC podcasts. 130 children took part in an unusual sleepover at the weekend at the Opera House in Rome, in Italy. The children, aged between 8 and 10, were able to sing, dance, make costumes and watch rehearsals as part of an initiative to make opera more accessible to younger audiences. The general manager of the Opera House, Francesco Giambrone, spoke to Tim Franks.
It's a special idea from an Italian theatre, because we think that the opera theatre will be a place for everyone, not only a place for an elite. So we
decided to invite 130 young people to sleep in the theater, to live in the theater, to feel home in the theater. And it was very exciting for us and also for the young people.
So what did they do other than just sleep in the theatre, which I'm sure must have been a thrill in its own way? What sorts of things did they see and hear?
Oh, they did a lot of activities. The first thing was to attend a rehearsal of our orchestra and choir conducted by our musical director, Michele Mariotti, and it was incredible, the silence of these young people during the rehearsals. And then they visited the theater. They had a guided tour of the theater to discover the phantom.
You have a ghost?
Yes, a ghost.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, that must have been terrifying for the children.
No. It's a good one.
It's a friendly
Yes, guy. She's a singer. She was in the past the general manager of the theatre.
I mean, all this sounds totally wonderful. Did they actually get to see any opera?
For most of them, it was the first time at Teatro Costanzi, the first time in an opera theatre. But we have a lot of educational program for the school, for children. We have some hope that in the future these 130 children could be a part of our audience.
I wonder whether you think that Italy has a special responsibility to educate its children, because you have such a magnificent tradition in opera.
Yes, this is true, but this is a general problem. But it's true. Italy has more responsibilities because melodrama was born in Italy. But we are doing a lot because we have a good percentage of young people in our audience, and because our audience is more than 90% of occupation of the theatre.
Francesco Giambroni at the Opera House in Rome. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, drop us an email. We love hearing from you. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or on X, we are @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Abby Wiltshire. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
I was drawn to the mountains even as a little girl, simply out of a passion and a desire to move around in nature.
Five mountaineers with the same personal goal: to be the first woman to climb all 14 of the world's highest peaks.
I wanted to push myself to the limit.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their inspiring story.
You find something inside you to continue.
Our own strength.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.